Hello, everybody, and welcome to Kentucky Ag Matters, a podcast designed to inform and educate both producers and consumers about all matters affecting agriculture. On this week's show, David, Jay, and Vicki will visit with Dr. Jeff Lemkewer, Associate Extension Professor with the Department of Animal and Food Sciences at the University of Kentucky. Our topic this week will be meeting the nutritional needs of the fall calving herd during the winter, and as always, we will wrap things up with this week's timely tip. Thanks so much for joining us. We hope you enjoy the show. Well, hello, everybody.
Hey, Jay. How are you doing?
I am doing well, Vicki. How about yourself?
I'm doing well. I'm doing very well.
Things good in Webster County?
They are good in Webster County. Yeah, we're recording. Yeah. We are recording, here at the end of October here, and we got about 1.3 inches of rain last night.
So. You don't have to tell us how good things are in Webster County because we've seen it all year long, haven't we, David?
Well, you summer asked. Long.
I did ask, but it was just being nice. I really didn't need to know.
Evidently, we're all not living right.
Vicki is the only preacher more than others. But it's been like that all summer. Vicki's gotten, she's living in this little fishbowl that gets rain every time it rains and gets more rain than everybody else. Crops up there looked amazing all summer long. And, it just is way better than it is anywhere where I'm around, that's for sure.
A little bit of that bled over into the edge of Hopkins County out there, just this side of Providence, back between Madisonville and Providence. The rains that went through seemed like all of them were timely to the point that things in that area looked really, really well. But
I agree.
We're on into the end of October now when we're recording this. It won't get published for another 3 weeks or a month or so. But hopefully between now and then, everybody's had plenty of rains. And
we hope.
It's to the point now most of that rain is just going to recharge the groundwater and help put some subsoil moisture back in, which we desperately need. It's dry down deep. But we hope some of the timeliness of this is helping you and folks around. So, guest today, we're in Lexington. Dr. Jeff Lemkewer is going to visit with us, talk to us a little bit about feeding our fall calving herd. And, Jeff, why don't you start off, just tell us a little bit about yourself and how long you've been at UK, where you're from, all the pertinence.
Sure thing, Jay. So grew up in Indiana, just about an hour west of Louisville, kind of that Jasper, Ferdinand area. So we like to call it Kentuckiana. Very similar. Went on and actually was at University of Wisconsin after I got my PhD and worked up there, and then had an opportunity to get closer to home and out of the tundra. Those winters get really long up there.
I bet they do. That's a whole different kind of cold up there.
It is. It starts about Halloween and ends about Easter.
Yeah, so it's too much, too long.
Too much and too long.
Too much snow.
Yeah. But last year we had, I think it was about 108 inches, and it stayed all winter.
Nah.
Yeah. I could stand on the snow drift on the side of the road and hit the power lines.
No kid.
Yeah. Oh. Kids loved it, though.
Oh, yeah.
I'm sure. Uh-huh.
You could make some massive snow forts and that kind of stuff.
Oh, I'm sure, yeah.
Tunnels and everything.
We had that back in 78. And I hope to never see that again in my lifetime. So, hopefully we've got that out of our system here, I'm hoping.
77, 78, to be specific. I remember we had Christmas break that year. I was in the fourth grade. We went back to school the first day back after Christmas, in January. Mm-hmm. We went to school one day. We left that afternoon and didn't come back to school until the day before Valentine's Day. Yep. We missed 6 solid weeks of school and went to school on Saturdays and all that good stuff.
That was awful.
To make it up. But
See, I'm the baby, I guess, in this group, because all I vaguely remember is when we lived on my grandfather's dairy farm, and that year cows walked out on the pond and broke through the ice. Couldn't see it.
Yeah.
Talk about a disaster.
Yeah. Guarantee it.
I've heard of that happening in other places. So glad to have you with us today. And got a lot of things to talk about, but anything in particular right offhand that you're working on that you want to get out before we dive into our topic?
Well, this is a hot topic right now when we look at input prices and feed prices and no rain for weeks and no fall growth. So we've been doing a lot of programs talking about how to manage, and I think, when you sit back and look at it, it's not so much about how do I find cheap feed. it's how do I build in some more margin? Mm-hmm. And I think that's the way you need to sit back and look at this.
Right.
You know, Dr. Toich mentioned back in, I think it was January, when fertilizer prices were so high, and he had mentioned that there's about $70 to $75 a ton of hay in fertilizer, a fertilizer value in a ton of hay. And the weather's dry right now, and people are feeding hay, and, you know, now's the time to be thinking about putting that hay out in these pasture areas and moving those hay bales around, either bale grazing or unrolling, however you want to do it, to spread some of that fertilizer value mm-hmm. back out across these fields, because it's not muddy.
Yeah.
The grass is dormant. You're not going to hurt anything. And so if you've got some areas, try to think about how to manage this hay feeding right now mm-hmm. to take advantage of it and save some fertility value in the future.
Yeah, there's two really good times to unroll hay, when it's really, really dry, or it's froze.
Amen.
So, you know, if you've got an opportunity to unroll hay right now and it's still dry, and, you know, I think that's a good way to move that fertility around the farm and have a plan in place to do that. Just don't go out there all willy-nilly and just do whatever. But, you know, try to pick a pasture that maybe the fertility is low. That you can kind of build up some of that fertility to help yourself in the long run, especially on these fertilizer prices.
Exactly. And right now, the other thing is take inventory on hay, because there we did have that rain that came back, and we got a nice rebound in forage, and people did get some surplus hay. So there's hay for sale, and it's always mm-hmm. cheaper right now than it is in February.
Yeah, don't wait till the last minute, and don't wait till you absolutely have to have it to get it, because my guess is around February, March timeline, this hay is going to be pretty high.
Yeah.
That's just a guess, and there's no guarantees. But, you know, if we continue to go along the route we've been going, that's where we're going to be.
I've always felt like as long as a producer had the ability to store it properly, mm-hmm. get it when you can get it. Yeah. Earlier in the years, by far, going to be the cheapest and most available. Not
yep.
just cheapest, but most available.
Yep. Yep. And feeding, you know, they say – you know, some of this really late cut hay, you're talking about a lot of broom sage possibly and some things of this nature. So, you know, we obviously don't necessarily want to feed that and say, well, it's better than a snowball. Well, maybe, maybe not.
Yeah, right.
You know, it may not be better than a snowball. But, you know, and that's the good thing about that is you need to be testing that hay and get that hay test. And you may want to kind of elaborate on the importance of testing your hay, but, you know, you need to know what that is to be able to supplement those cows to meet their nutritional needs.
And I think you nailed it there. And that's the one thing, even Tuesday night when I was doing a program, somebody asked me, they said, so how many people are actually testing their hay? And I said, well, let's find out. There were about 40 people there, about 10% of the people in the room.
Yeah.
And this wasn't a strange group. They know that, you know, it's like the old Nike logo, just do it. That's what you need to do with testing your hay. Just do it.
Yeah.
Yep.
But,
yep.
You know, that's the one thing, because if you know the protein and the energy value in that forage, we can match that up to the production stage of these cows. If you've got spring calvers that you're fixing to wean here in the next few weeks, their nutritional need is going to be relatively low because they're not lactating anymore. So feed that lowest quality hay that you got to them, maybe separate out those thin cows that need a little bit of TLC and put some condition back on them. But, you know, on the flip side, you look at these fall calving cows that start calving in September, they're getting close to hitting peak at 6 to 8 weeks after they've calved.
Mm-hmm.
They're in their highest nutritional needs, and so we can match that forage up to meet those needs and save a little money on that bucket that we're taking grain out to.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. You need to know what, you know, what your nutritional value is of that hay so you be able to supplement it for those cows to meet their, you know, at whatever stage she is.
When they need it.
Right, when they need it. And, you know, people talk about, you know, not being able to put weight on cows, you know, and on for a spring calving herd right now, wean those calves off, and right now is the time to be able to put that weight on those cows. And several years ago, back 06, 07, Kevin Laurent and I did that study down at my place that we dry lotted those cows. And, you know, I never would have expected, because we took weights on the cows when we put them in, we took weights on them when we came out, and they gained 135 pounds in the dry lot.
And that's
so if you have an opportunity to put those cows in a dry lot, and the hay was 10% protein, 51% TDN, more than met their nutritional needs at that time, at that stage of their life. And so, you know, we're putting on, you can put on weight on these cows. You just, and that's no supplement or nothing. So it can be done. You just, you know, you got to know all the information to be able to do it.
Yeah, and there's one thing that we forget about, and I always talk to producers about this in the springtime, but it applies right now. When we roll into March and we start seeing that grass start greening up, those cows really want to start go nipping at that. And we're like, yeah, no more fighting that mud hauling hay out, right?
That's right.
But I always tell producers, you can literally watch those cows walk the fat off of their back because they're trying to go out across that whole daggone field and consume 300 to 350 pounds of forage, and it's a half inch tall. Y'all go out there with your two front fingers and your thumb and see how long it takes you to pick 300 pounds of forage when it's a half inch tall. Yep. You expend a lot of energy traveling, and so you put them in that dry lot. It's the same thing right now. You've reduced their quote-unquote energy they're expending traveling across these pastures trying to find something that's green. Mm-hmm. They're in a small area. They belly up to the hay bale, and they can eat, and they got 20, 30 feet to walk to water. Life's good.
Yeah, yeah. I think more folks need to think about doing that, too. On our way up to Lexington, I actually saw – you know, I didn't see any pastures that needed to be grazed right now at this point. You know, everybody needed to probably have been in a dry lot of some sort feeding some kind of supplemental hay because there's nothing, you know, there was nothing out there right now. And I think, you know, if we continually graze those pastures, we're not doing anything but hurting ourselves in the future simply because we're hurting that grass, you know, as far as it being able to regenerate, you know, when it does warm up or get some rain, even in the spring. I think you're going to have a harder time getting that grass to come out and grow.
Yeah, and you'll hear Dr. Smith and Dr. Toich talk about that and Dr. Henning as well. You know, the harder we beat these pastures up in the fall, early winter, the slower it is to come on in the springtime. Yeah. So you're right. That's the other thing that we're going to deal with is you've got some issues now where these pastures are going to probably get beat up, and now there's no residue out there. And as soon as we get some rain, I'm afraid these pastures are really going to get pugged up even worse, and we're going to have some issues that we're going to need to think about renovating fields in the springtime.
Yeah, and, you know, that's not the greatest time to think about that. So, you know, when we actually did a podcast with Dr. Smith that will come out after the first of the year, and we talked about that, about what we can do. So folks that are listening, be listening for that coming up right after the first of the year. But we talked about what we can do in the spring, you know, to as far as, you know, extending grazing or what we can do in the short term to help our grazing, you know, those type things. So folks need to be on the lookout for that for sure.
Before we leave the hay testing topic too, you know, we encourage everybody to test their hay, but, you know, just like soil tests or anything else, you need to do that in the proper way, and using a hay probe is going to be the way you need to do that. It's reaching in and getting a handful is not the way we need to be doing that. So, and a lot of extension offices, at least in Kentucky, a lot of the ag agents have hay probes that you can call and you can use those, and but just make sure that we do that in a proper way so that we get a good sample that we can rely on, that it's a reliable sample for the hay.
That's a really good point. And I'd also, if you're out there buying hay, try to buy hay that's been tested so you know what you get. There's been too many quote-unquote straw bales bought because they didn't have that forage test.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of this, some of this hay is way too mature when folks get to it. And I mean, it's not, I'm not knocking people that are selling hay. It's just when you get to it, you get to it. And a lot of it is way too mature. So Dr. Limcooter, what are some things that we can do or producers can do to kind of stretch that hay supply? You know, what are some specific things that they can do to try to move that along throughout the winter? Because I think we're going to have some pretty tough times coming up.
Yeah, and there's a couple things we can think about as alternative feeds. And so you can think about commodities, but nobody wants to talk about commodities because they're $300 a ton or even in some instances more than that.
Yep.
But in areas like where you guys are thinking, hay prices are probably going to be high because, you know, you guys didn't have as good of yields. Mm-hmm. And our big round bales don't, you know, you can't put as many on a semi-trailer. And so transportation costs get pretty high. And so that regional hay market causes your all's hay demand to go up. And you could be looking at $150 to $175 a ton for something that's 8 to 10% protein, low 50s on TDN. I starts making these co-products at $300 a ton look pretty competitive price-wise. So when we start doing that, we always talk about, you know, you need a minimum of somewhere around 25% of that cow's dry matter intake to be roughage. And anything that we do to think about stretching hay, we're going to reduce the hay we allow that cow to have access to and then come in and supplement energy protein with a commodity feed of some sort or some of our distillery byproduct feedstuffs. But the goal is always to deliver the nutrition that cow needs for that stage of production. And so we can stretch hay. That is not a problem. Bring in those commodity feeds as they fit price-wise. Think about a supplement that maybe has an ionophore in there that will give us a little bit more energy for every bite that cow takes. We have less methane produced, so that's a greenhouse gas reducer there, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's all carbon credits. So,
that's right.
But from a cost standpoint, you know, Dr. Johns, my predecessor, did some work here at the Versailles farm, and he found that if we fed Rumensin or an ionophore like Rumensin or Bovatec to our cows, and we restricted the hay, we could get by and maintain the body condition score on these cows with 15% less hay, just by using that one technology.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something to think about. Now, with ionophores in cows, we've got to have it in at least a pound of grain supplement. We can't free choice that like we can in a stocker system or a replacement heifers. But that's a tool to think about. And on the other side is, you know, when you look at, say, commodities, there's a big price differential from one dealer or location to the next. And so you need to be thinking about shopping around a little bit. I heard this week that somebody's bringing peanut hulls up out of the South. And that happened back in, I think it was 08, 09, when corn prices got so high. Be careful. Peanut hulls, there's not a whole lot of value in those. If you ever chewed on one of those, it's like chewing on wood, right?
That's right. That's right.
So the point on that is that hulls are not hulls. Soybean hulls are a high digestible fiber, good energy. Peanut hulls are not so good, and rice hulls are even worse. So you need to talk to your extension agent or your nutritionist and find out. When you go in and you say, I want a really cheap feed, yeah, I can make you a really cheap feed, but it may not be a good feed. So talk to your extension agents and nutritionists to find out what it is that they're blending in some of these co-product blends to make sure that you're getting what you need and you're not just trying to save $20 a ton and it's going to cost you. So that's the big deal is to kind of think about what you're going to feed and what you have access to.
Yep. What, you know, I know there has been some work done on limiting cows, the time, if you will, that cows can have access to hay. And it seems to, after a bit, they seem to become, you know, they know the time, so they go in there and eat. And then when you get them out, I mean, they still consume about the same amount or maybe less, but, you know, you're limiting the time. They don't waste as much, it seems like.
Yeah, that's a good point. So it was back in the 80s when Purdue first did some of that work, and then Illinois followed it up in the, like, early 2000s. And you can go on good condition cows. And that's the thing that I got to tell everybody to watch this fall, because these cows are coming off, and our hay quality is never as good as that fall pasture growth, so they're not going to rebound. Mm-hmm. So make sure they're in good body flesh. But if they're in good condition, then they're mature cows. Do not use two-year-olds, three-year-olds, developing heifers. Don't do this strategy with any of those young females because they're still trying to grow. But mature cows are good flesh. The work would suggest that on a good quality hay, 6 to 8 hours access to hay a day will maintain body condition score on a mid-gestational beef cow. So you've turned their attitude into, I'm going to put my head on this slot in the hay feeder, and then I'm going to run around the bell feeder and push all these cows around and see what's over there, to where they get that slot, and they just stay there and they eat. And so they're not pulling their head in and out and pulling a lot of hay down under their feet and stomping it down in the mud.
Yep.
So intake goes down a little bit, but you're right. The waste goes down pretty dramatically based on the work.
Yeah, I thought that was always something. And, you know, we've talked about that when we've had droughts before, you know, folks, or hay supplies were short. You know, we've talked about doing some of those things. So I thought it was pretty interesting work just to, you know, if you have the capacity to do that, and that's a little more trouble. But then again, if you, you know, if you were to leave for work and turn them in, and then when you got home from work, you know, get them out, I mean, that's obviously something that you could do that.
Yeah, I mean, Jacob. And this is what you would want to do, Jay. You'd want to turn them out at night. So get home about 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock, turn those cows out to the hay in the morning, lock them away from the hay. The other thing that will do is the data would say it would trick them in the cabin during the day, not at night.
Yeah. We feed our heifers at 7 o'clock at night. That's when we feed them. And I don't give them very much, like a pound or two, just to try to make that happen. And it works about 90% of the time. So
nothing
I'm
negative,
pretty tickled with that.
Nothing negative about calving during the daylight hours.
Zero.
No. That's right.
I don't like getting up at 3 or 4 in the morning necessarily, like 2 in the morning.
Yeah, yeah. That's what I try to keep from happening is getting up in the middle of the night. I don't mind getting up at 4 o'clock and going up there, and that's what I usually do. But, I mean, that middle of the night stuff, because I can't go back to sleep.
Yeah,
so, you know.
And we know you need your beauty sleep.
Yeah, I probably need way more than I'm getting, I promise you that. You got a good face for radio is all I can tell you.
Amen.
Yeah.
So the other thing that we need to roll back and think about is, you know, think about our past experiences and what we've done. When we've had dry years in the past and we, you know, maybe we bailed up some CRP hay that really wasn't that good, you know, twigs trees and sticks don't make good hay. Edit that out, Jay.
Yeah.
But, you know, back then, molasses was really common. And what we do is tip those bales up on in, take 5-gallon bucket of molasses and go around that. And And y'all remember those days.
Absolutely.
Yes.
And they got even so inventive that they made these injectors.
Injectors, yeah.
Yep.
And when I worked at Southern States, we actually had one that we put. I guess the product back then was that mole mix, and we injected lots and lots of bales with that stuff.
Yeah, and so molasses has kind of gotten expensive. It comes out of the south, you know, that South Gulf Coast area, and it's energy expensive to process and then to haul back up here. But we've got something close that's very similar. It's high in protein, you know, 25%, 18%, 20%. Would be common in the syrup, 25% to 28% in wet distillers grains and stillage. But these distillery byproducts can serve a purpose similar to that, too.
And they're more available now than they've ever been in this state.
Absolutely. And going to continue to increase in availability based on what we hear about new distilleries opening up.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, these distillery byproducts, like the syrup, it's kind of a consistency of a thin pudding. You know, you could potentially pour some of that on these hay bales. It'll go through it a little bit faster, so you may have to watch how much you put on. If you've got a hay grinder or maybe a vertical TMR mixer that will process hay, you can think about including it there. We've got some guys around here that are close to these distilleries that are using vertical mixers and making a TMR for their cow herd. You know, years ago when, you know, the ethanol boom kicked in, a lot of our colleagues in the other Corn Belt states started looking at trying to preserve hay and or really utilize these co-products in a timely manner. And what they would do is they would grind hay, bring in a tanker of syrup or back then it was mostly syrup. We had some folks that were actually doing it with distiller's grains too. But we'd take that syrup, blend it in with hay, and then put it in an ag bag, and then just feed that out through the wintertime. And part of the reasons for that was you could take some real low-quality forages like corn stalks that we were talking about earlier. We could take corn stalks and grind it, or wheat straw and grind it, add some of this stuff, syrup to it, and then bring that protein and energy value up and take a low-quality forage and make it a maintenance-type forage mm-hmm. for a cow. Mm-hmm. Cost money, right? You got money in processing the hay. You got money in bagging it. So the syrup has to be pretty low cost. And, Jay, you mentioned there's a lot of it here. You know, we can get that stuff pretty cheap now.
Right.
And we've got some places on the stillage side that are paying folks to haul that stuff away. Mm-hmm. So we're trying to take we got a little study that we just started on a very small scale. And we've taken some stillage and we've ground some fescue hay, just average good grass hay in this state, right?
All right.
And ground it, and I wanted to know, well, what could we mix? How much could we mix into that? And I was able to mix, it was one-third hay, two-thirds stillage, and it soaked up all that stillage, believe it or not. And then so we put that in an ag bag or in a small bag and made these mini silos and pulled a vacuum on it. Then we did that with salt too, because I want to see, when we make homemade bread, you don't think about it, but you're putting salt in homemade bread. It's not just for taste. It's an antifungal, so that mold sure. doesn't grow.
Preservative yeah. as such.
Yeah. And so years ago at the Princeton, one of the first beef bashes, I did some this kind of same stuff, and we put salt on the top, and it kept all the mold off the top of that. So mm-hmm. we've incorporated a little salt in this to see if it would help prevent mold in some of these mixes too.
So how long is that going to stay in the bag before y'all kind of break it open and see what you've got?
Yeah, so we were finishing up a study, and I had this left over, and so we went ahead and just did this about 2 weeks ago, and I'm going to let it go about 6 weeks.
Okay.
Normally what I'd like to do is, you know, put that stuff in there in July, and then, because that's when we maybe have some time in between hay harvests mm-hmm. and before we get into doing other crops. And then let it go through that hot summer and mm-hmm. see how it would do see in that hot summer. But this is just some preliminary work for us to get started on this. And
I don't know how this would play in, but as I'm looking at this in my mind, I'm thinking for those years when we have leftover hay in the spring from over the feed, you need a place to put it. You need to get it out of your storage so you can put your new hay in. That may be an option for some of those products in the years that we have them.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point. You know, the stillage and the syrup and all that comes in at a low pH, around 3.2, 3.4. Corn silage runs around 4. And so, you know, maybe it will keep that hay that you mentioned there, Jay, through that summer month. And if nothing else, if it would even get us 6 months, you know, then think about what you're mm-hmm. talking about. David, we go in there July and start feeding this, let our pastures rebound for that fall.
Absolutely.
Might be another strategy.
Yeah, I think there's lots of folks that have fall calving cows that this would work great for them as we get, you know, up to calving, and then we're saving our best hay for after they calve, obviously. But if we needed some, you know, because we have that late summer, it's not very much growing other than in Webster County and you know, that kind of thing. There's no grass. You know, this would be kind of a good maintenance diet up until, you know, they get ready and start calving.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
So I'd be interested to see if you know, what's the thoughts if you had an old bunker silo, you know, could you potentially do this same thing? And I mean, what's the spoilage and, you know, that kind of thing going to be in an open air type situation?
Yeah, and you know, with syrup back and wet cake, they actually did that back in Nebraska and the Dakotas and that, South Dakota, and they did put it in a bunker, and it did keep, but you got to cover it, right? So right. You got to get a plastic. Ideally, take just like we would silage in a bunker, we'd get a plastic liner and cover it. You just want to keep the oxygen out of that stuff.
Yeah. So, were they able to pack it any at all just yep. to push some of the air out?
Yep, they got up in there and they packed it. Yep. You need to really try to try to pack some of that a little bit just to keep some of that spoilage down.
That particular product, I didn't know how well it would handle weight of equipment on it or anything like that.
Yeah, it's not ideal, but you know, if you got a good bunker, you can get up on there and pack that stuff down some. Yeah.
What about differences in temperature? I know, you know, the temperature is a little bit different in North Dakota than it is here, and the humidity too, from that standpoint. You know, if we're talking about just trying to think outside the box a little bit and doing some of that old hay like Jay was talking about in maybe June or something, are we going to be able to, is that going to keep, you know, and then obviously putting the salt in is going to help preserve, is that going to keep long enough for us to be able to get use out of it?
That's TBD, right? To be determined. So, and that was my kind of leading comment, that I'd like to have done this back in July and then run it through. So, the week of July the 4th, we put distiller's grains in a hay bale bunker that we did down at Princeton for Beef Bash. So it sat through the heat of the summer till September when we had Beef Bash. Mm-hmm. And we opened it up, and it's just like corn silage. Right underneath the plastic, you had about 3 to 4 inches of spoilage. And then you got down in the face of that, and it looked just like it was the day that we put it in there. Now, that was straight distiller's grains.
Okay.
But now what happened, and I blamed Higgins that he had his composting pile right over there, that his dead animals were stinking. It really wasn't the compost pile. All that oil that went in went rancid. And so you had this rancid fat kind of odor coming out of it. Mm-hmm. But we measured mycotoxins and all that, and there was nothing wrong, and we wound up feeding it to the heifers, and the heifers did quite well on it. So,
For those folks that maybe don't have any experience with silage, which is probably a good bit of folks here in Kentucky. Yeah. You know, you have that, you know, you're talking about that spoilage. Kind of explain a little bit about the spoilage and then explain kind of what you do with that.
Yeah. So when you got, you know, that top layer, it's not packed well, and you wind up getting kind of fermentation. It's driving some heat and moisture up, and it comes up and it hits that plastic, and then it kind of washes the acids that might have been there away. And so you get some spoilage, some mold and fungal growth there. And then the detrimental part on that is it negatively impacts intake. And what we typically would recommend is that we take that off and throw it over on the manure pile or compost pile, because it does have a significant reduction on intake when you mix that in. There also can be some risk of maybe some mold intake issues, spores. Too many mold spores can cause some intestinal problems and maybe even lead to some potential abortions. Mm-hmm. So we don't like to feed a lot of mold like that. But it happens because of, you know, it's not well packed at the top. You got that moisture coming up and washing those acids away. So try to scrape that off if we can. But, you know, if you do a good job on managing the face of that silo, it'll be pretty minimal. The problem is a lot of guys don't want to pay the money for the plastic to cover it, and they want to try something like wheat on top and that. Mm-hmm.
I remember that from years ago, folks sowing wheat on top.
Yeah, and it doesn't really do a good job of shedding that water like we'd like. You'll get still spoilage. And corn, at the price of what you got to plant corn to harvest corn, it's too expensive to be thrown away. So we want to preserve as much of that silage as we can and keep that mold from growing.
From a basic chemistry standpoint, for those, like David said, not familiar with silage, that acid that is leaching out is necessary for the ensiling process, for the fermentation to take place. So you need those to stay present. I'm interested more in what you said about some of these stillage products being so much of a lower pH. I have to think that might help in that process, or you know, as far as they go. But you were talking about removing that layer to get to that feed. Growing up, we called that opening up a silo, and that's what you did at the beginning of the year in concrete stave silos, is you had to climb up in the top and fork so much of it out to get down to that, get that top layer off to get down to the good silage. So.
And it's the same in our bunkers, right? You got that slope face, and we're opening that pit up, and so we got to throw all that ramp away because it's usually spoiled.
What about these ag bags? I mean, you know, you're still going to have some of that. I mean, how do you handle that? Maybe that's something that's an option for somebody, you know.
Yeah, and the ag bags are really the way most of our beef guys need to think about going, because you can get down to like an 8-foot diameter bag, and you know, that sure beats a 24-foot wide bunker when we've got 60, 80 mama cows. So You need to think about an ag bag. I know it's expensive, and you maybe have a mess. You just got to plan for it. You got to put concrete pad down or good gravel base with some packed rock on top. Keep yourself out of the mud. But the ag bags certainly are nice. They're quick filling. They're quick unloading. You can have different cuts on, you know, if you're doing alfalfa or sorghum sedan and corn silage, you can have different bags with different feedstuffs in it. So there's a lot of opportunities there to use those ag bags, and they tend to minimize the waste. As long as we keep the tape on the holes and that kind of mm-hmm. stuff, they do mm-hmm. minimize the waste.
That's where I became a fan of them, is the fact that you just don't lose that much product out of them. Long as you say you protect the holes mm-hmm. and repair areas, because you'll have some damage. You can't avoid some damage to them. But,
mm-hmm. Yeah, and a little common sense goes a long ways. You know, don't put that thing underneath the tree row, because the mm-hmm. limbs and that fall down, and the birds and all the raccoons Poultry. And everything. Yeah. Yeah. Keep it out in an open area.
Yeah. Yeah. So the majority of that silage or the product that's in those bags is usable, I guess, is what I'm asking.
Yeah,
for those of us that don't know,
it'd be very minimal spoilage at the ends, because okay. where you're opening it up, mm-hmm. you don't pull a vacuum or a lot of vacuum necessarily right there on the end. And so when you first open it up, you got to throw that first few feet out.
I got you.
Yep. But other than that, it's pretty minimal waste.
Yeah. So those are some things that folks can think about, as far as, planning ahead. And one of the things we've talked about on this program all the time is you need to have a plan A and possibly a plan B and maybe even a plan C at times. But, we need to think about planning this stuff way ahead of time to keep out of the problems that some of us are experiencing right now,
And two, on the testing side of it, it's important to get that silage, that testing that and I think there are several different labs you can send those to, but making sure that those are tested too, not just our conventional hay.
Yeah, absolutely. And Jeff, you may want to just mention some of the labs you can send that stuff to.
Sure, and especially coming out of a drought year, we're always concerned about nitrates. And so with corn silage and sorghum sedans and that, we want to get those tested. So you can get nitrates tested at the diagnostic labs, but for forage quality and your nitrates, and get a fermentation profile while you're at it on these fermented feeds, Dairy One, Cumberland Labs, Rock River Labs. You can send samples off to Ward. There are many commercial labs out there that we can send these to. And you're looking at, depending on what you want done, if you want a silage NIR plus fermentation profile, you're probably looking at about $40. And that's sure cheaper than having a dead animal.
That's right.
Absolutely. Are there anything on those tests that when we send those off, is there something we need to – do we need to have the results back in a certain form or on our as-fed basis or a wet, a dry basis? Or how do we need to get that information back?
Yeah, that's a good question. And a lot of the labs are going to send you both as-fed and dry matter. And one of the common calls I get is, why is my corn silage so bad this year? It's only like 3% protein. Because you're looking at something that's got 65% moisture in it, and you're looking at that as-fed column and not that dry matter column. So always look at the dry matter values, and on your fermentation profiles, we're wanting to look at that pH. Like I said, corn silage should get down in the fours to make sure, Jay, that we got that acid to preserve it. So then what we look at is the acids that are there. We don't want butyric acid. That's a clostridial fermentation, and it will smell like a dirty baby diaper or something like that. Yeah, not too good a smell. How'd you like to put your head down and start
not
chowing
too good.
Down?
Yeah, it wouldn't be good at all.
Neither
do
cows. So we're looking at a high lactic acid and some acetic acid, which is vinegar. But we want a lot more lactic acid in there. It's a stronger organic acid that will preserve that, and that means we got a good fermentation. But to control shelf life, we might see a little bit more acetic in some of these products that we're adding in to promote fermentation to get a little bit more stability. You may see acetic acid coming up a little higher.
Yeah.
But lactic and acetic are what we're looking for, no butyric.
That way you get the fermentation, but you don't get the added microbial growth, bacterial growth.
Yep. And as Jay said, we don't hardly ever do this program that we don't think about another program that we could do. Obviously when you get some results back on on some of this syrup. And hey, we would love to sit down and get that out for our listeners, you know, and talk about that and the results that you get, because I think that's got some potential there. You know, especially for some of this rougher hay that we may have put up, or some of this hay that we have left over that, like Jay talked about, I think those will be some phenomenal uses for that, you know, for those products and being able to use some of those products.
Yeah, and you know, I know it's not maybe real practical right now when you think about you got to have a hay processor and a mixer and a bagger, but we might be able to come up with a solution to that. Maybe a individual decides to invest in and have a portable system. Years ago, we had some folks that had one of those, and we might be able to see if we get cost share money or something for something like that. But realize there's these small craft distilleries that are popping up in the countryside, and they can't invest in a drying system. So maybe this gives some of our cow-calf guys an opportunity to go over there and get some low-cost feed that's relatively high in energy, high in protein, and just we can feed it at the right levels and not cause problems.
Right.
Have some cheap supplement. Yep.
I've seen, you know, in down in our part of the state, the western part of the state, I've seen some hay processors that have come through that are stopping at some of the stocker guys and processing hay. So there are those folks out there. You know, if you can get a hold of them, and I'm sure if you'll check with your county extension office, they can help you. And if they can't find one, well, we can always refer back to Jeff and some of his contacts and see if we can't find you somebody.
Yep. That's right. I tell you what, it's been a pretty good show so far. We've talked about a lot of good information. Jeff, one of the things we try to do every week is towards the end of the show, we try to wrap up with a timely tip that's pertinent to the time, you know, of the year that folks will be listening and needing things. And this week's timely tip is to match the nutritional needs of your cow herd with the best available forage resources you have, and then supplement as needed. We've talked about the differences between a spring calving herd and a fall calving herd, and that fall calving herd is going to have a lot higher nutritional demand right after they calve. One, because we're going to have to get them in shape to get ready to breed back, but two, we're working into the wintertime, and they're just going to have overall higher nutritional needs. That typically adds to the fact of why it costs a little more to fall calve than it does to spring calve. It's maintaining those nutritional needs. But anything else you want to add to that as far as matching those hays to the right time of the year to feed?
I think Vicki's been hammering on it too, right? Just forage tests is where you got to start.
And then, too, if you're new to getting in the cattle business or just thinking about rations and all of that, just if you need help, there's, you know, contact the extension offices to get that information. You know, we can call folks like Dr. Limcooler here to help us out with that. But make sure that, you know, we need a good bit of information to be able to build the right ration for you. And so, you know, just make sure you...
Yeah, we have those resources to help you build a ration, you know, if we just need to. And I'll give my shameless plug that I couldn't think of the other day when we did a podcast, but our shameless plug for our extension offices to, you know, contact your extension agent. They have the resources to help you get this information. So, you know, they're going to need a good bit of information from you, but then after you get that information, they can get a ration worked out fairly quickly.
Like you said a minute ago, David, we think about all the ideas for different shows. One of these days, we probably could make a show just out of the software that we use for balancing rations and putting together that information.
Yep. So, absolutely.
Pretty good stuff. Well, we want to thank you, Jeff. We appreciate you being here with us this week, and also thank our host for this week's information, and also thanks to our listeners for joining in. We hope you've enjoyed our show, and we'll make plans to join us again next week for our next episode. And until then, remember, Kentucky Ag matters.